faith-filled finance. All major UK bank accounts. One app. Provision is built by Christians to help you steward what God's given you. Track your spending, saving, and giving in one place. Join the waitlist now at provision.money and get your first month free. That's provision.money.
The Leadership File on Premier.
It's my joy to welcome you to The Leadership File, the show that aims to help you lead as Christ would have you lead wherever he has placed you. I'm Andy Peck, your host, and whether you listen live on a Sunday or one of the many thousands who catch up via the podcast, it's great that you can join us. We're all familiar with the way in which our modern world seems happy to follow the lead of celebrities, sometimes even in the Christian world, where those who speak at conferences and write books can have a disproportionate influence. Well, this week I'm joined by Colin Holtz, the co-author of a book that aims to shed light on leaders in the last 200 years who led with rather more substance. It's entitled Moral Leadership for a Divided Age. The book looks at 14 people who, in the words of the subtitle, dared to change the world. It includes some you might expect, Nelson Mandela, Martin Luther King Jr., Mother Teresa, and also some names you may not know, Ida D. B. Wells, Barnett, and Harriet Tubman. There are two Brits you will know, William Wilberforce and Florence Nightingale. That's obviously if you're listening in the UK. So to discuss the book and its theme, Colin joins us from his home in Atlanta, Georgia. So welcome, Colin.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Congratulations on a superbly written and researched book. How did the book come about?
Well, we each had our own stories that combined to produce this book. David Gushy, my co-author, is a distinguished Christian ethicist here in the United States. He had been teaching a class on moral leadership for about 20 years. It had evolved over time, and he needed one book that really was a short introduction to all the leaders he was profiling in class, in part just to be kind to his students and not ask them to purchase 14 different full-length biographies.
Right, yeah.
He and I also shared a concern about the way ethics was landing in churches and the lack of leadership in the world around us, the difficulty of starting with rules and principles and ideas and trying to change people's behavior based on that. And we wanted to explore a different way of trying to create change. So lifting up amazing stories that we can learn from, interrogate, be inspired by, and be shaped and formed by.
Absolutely. Thank you. And of course, a narrative and story is very much a way in which particularly the modern generation is looking to learn. So, I mean, your coverage of each leader includes historical context, early and private life, vocation, legacy and criticism, and leadership lessons. And each chapter ends with a set of discussion questions suitable for small groups. So what do you hope the book might accomplish, Colin?
Well, I'm hoping that it'll spark a conversation more than anything. I want readers to ask themselves who qualifies as a moral leader in their mind, who is maybe missing from the book, who didn't deserve to be in the book. We're not trying to present an exhaustive, definitive list based on what the two particular men in the United States happen to think and just declare it by fiat. We're hoping to open the door to a sort of evolving conversation about moral leadership. I'd love it if this was used at all sorts of levels. It is written in such a way that it can work for college students. My co-author teaches it to undergraduate students, university students. It also works at the master's level. And I just completed a reading group with a small group at my church. So it's a book that is accessible to people in a variety of different places in their lives. and who could all join this sort of ongoing conversation about who the moral leaders they admire are and for what reasons.
Great. Yeah. I mean, from time to time on this show, we discuss what leadership is. You explore this in the book, and I liked the simplicity of your definition. Leaders unite followers around a common goal, which, of course, can include people who may not be leaders in the kind of traditional sense of being appointed to a role.
Absolutely. And many of the leaders in this book are not what you think of when we have that sort of classic old-fashioned definition of the leader, the military leader, the political leader. You have some folks who led through moral influence, through example, through their writing. Some people led by creating an issue that other people didn't want to talk about. For instance, Ida B. Wells, I think, is such a fascinating story because Ida was not very successful at leading a major organization. However, she took an issue that really few dared to talk about, which was the lynching of black men in the American South, particularly in the Jim Crow period following the American Civil War. And she made it a national and international issue, in large part through two visits to Britain. And so she was able to lead on an issue without the sort of traditional platform or institution behind her that we tend to think of when we think of leaders.
Yeah. Now, not all the leaders selected are Christian, so you have Hindus, Muslims, and Jews. Did you consider confining your selection to Christian, or was that something you started off, from the beginning?
That's a great question, and a really important piece of this book. We were very intentional about including people who were not only Christian. There are other books, wonderful books, about Christian leaders who have been forgotten, Christian leaders who we need to recover. Our approach is that we live in this increasingly pluralistic world. We live in a world where Christians will have to dialogue with people who have different faiths or who have no faith at all. And we need sort of positive role models for how we might go about that dialogue and where we can establish a shared discourse. So this is another way of doing that. We can look and say, I admire Elie Wiesel. I admire Malala Yousafzai. I'm a Protestant Baptist. I admire John Paul II or Oscar Romero or Mother Teresa, people from different Christian traditions, but different faith traditions altogether. Someone who is Muslim may come at Malala from a completely different perspective than I do as a Christian, but we can start there, and then we can talk about, well, here's what I find inspiring. Oh, well, I find different things inspiring. Suddenly we're engaged in a productive, fruitful dialogue instead of starting with our differences. So we really see this as a potential for enlightening and fostering interreligious dialogue.
Well, Colin, we'll look a little later at some of those included. But of course, the inevitable question is, who didn't make the cut quite? And I understand Gandhi almost didn't get in, and I'm just wondering if there are other names that you had to omit in the end or decided not to.
Well, this list really evolved over the 20 years that David was teaching it. When I came into the project, we were working with a very short timeline, and so we had to be very judicious in terms of what changes we made to the people he had done significant research on previously. He had taught for a number of years Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the great Russian dissident.
Yes, yes, yeah.
And that's somebody who, I have a friend who was quite upset that Solzhenitsyn was left out, because when he took David's class, he did his final term paper on Solzhenitsyn. So he had done all this research and was very much looking forward to reading about him in the book, but he wasn't there. We actually include at the back of the book a list of dozens of potential leaders that didn't make the cut, or who, I wouldn't say didn't make the cut, who came across our desk in the process of this. And that's one of the interesting things. We start with the assumption in the introduction that we live in this world where everyone's focused on leadership, in part because we have this innate sense that leaders, true leaders, are lacking somehow. Or maybe that we just can't agree on who constitutes a leader, and we each have our own leader based on sort of what tribe or club or political loyalty or religious loyalty. As we moved through the project, people kept throwing name after name after name at us, and we realized that we are part of the problem, all of us as human beings. We've stopped being able to recognize leaders. And you mentioned celebrities in the introduction to the show. I think that's part of it. We confuse leadership with celebrity, and so we don't recognize all the many voices out there. I'll just throw one out. I've been reading my way through a biography of Alice Paul, an American suffragette who studied under the Pankhursts and then in Britain and then came back to the U.S. Finished a biography recently of Wangari Maathai, the environmental activist, Nobel Peace Prize winner. These are folks who, you know, almost as soon as we finished this book, people were suggesting a second volume.
Right, sure. Well, there's an opportunity for you, perhaps. Yeah, but thank you. I was impressed with your coverage of the two Brits that you considered, which is William Wilberforce and Florence Nightingale. They would be well known from a UK perspective, and I'm just interested in how an American sees their respective roles and what impressed you.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Wilberforce especially has a somewhat devoted following among American evangelicals, precisely because that was his background and his heritage, and the motivating force that led him into the anti-slavery fight. So he has really emerged over the last 30, 40 years as a quite admired figure among a particular subset of the American population, sort of the white and evangelical Christian community. Florence Nightingale, on the other hand, is somewhat of a different story because, you know, I covered her in my church group, and what most of the people who joined our small group expected of Florence Nightingale was a story of selfless sacrifice, a story of what it means to be, a devoted, caring nurse. And they found a figure who embodied all of those qualities, yes, but embodied so much more in her brilliance and her determination and her willingness to, you know, offer guidance to military leaders at a time when, you know, women were not expected to do such things. And so they found a much more complicated, much more interesting figure who was really formative for the period. I also think what's interesting from an American perspective is this book forces a global sense of history and helps us understand how different trends that have moved through our country are the result of trends that began in Britain or began in India, and how American policy has shaped some of the moral leaders that we talk about later in the book especially.
Well, you're listening to The Leadership File with me, Andy Peck. I'm joined this week by Colin Holtz, the co-author of a book that aims to shed light on leaders in the last 200 years, Moral Leadership for a Divided Age. We'll be back just after this. Welcome back to The Leadership File with me, Andy Peck. I'm joined this week by Colin Holtz. He's the co-author of a book that aims to shed light on leaders in the last 200 years who led. It's entitled Moral Leadership for a Divided Age. It looks at 14 particular people. We've considered a few of them as we've been talking before the break. Colin, when you if you had to select one leader who you kind of impressed you that you'd want to give as an example to listeners, who would that be?
Well, it'd probably be Ida B. Wells Barnett, but I mentioned her a moment ago, so sure. I'll throw out Harriet Tubman.
Okay.
Another figure that even a lot of Americans don't know a whole lot about, or what they know is wrong. She's commonly understood to be the founder of the Underground Railroad, which was an informal network that helped smuggle slaves out of slave states into free states and then eventually into Canadian territories where they were free from being re-enslaved. And this would be in the time prior to the American Civil War, so early 1800s. Tubman's a fascinating tale, I think, for two reasons. One is the way faith drives people. She really had this conversion moment where she felt called to pursue her own freedom, which was incredibly dangerous. To just set out and wander through you know, dark thickets, traveling under moonlight, at any moment risk being captured. And she crosses into freedom, and very quickly she decides, of all things, to go back. And she goes back over and over and over again, and she starts out small, rescuing a few family members and guiding them to safety. And then she realizes, well, she can't just focus on her own family. She needs to focus on people in their community, people around them. And so she starts bringing out other enslaved individuals who she knows but isn't related to, people who live nearby. And pretty soon she's feeling morally responsible for a whole host of individuals that are beyond her immediate family connections, beyond her immediate community. And in that practice, she becomes an example of one thing we talk about throughout the book, which is this sort of expansive circle of moral concern that all of these moral leaders had. They feel accountable for the welfare of incredibly broad communities, from nations to all of humanity. You see in Harriet Tubman a leader who started small, who didn't set out to change the entire world. She set out to rescue some family members, but as that circle grew, it changed her and it changed the course of human history.
Well, no, thank you. Well, look forward to discovering more about Harriet. Anything surprise you in your research, Colin, as you were working through these things?
A whole host of things. I was surprised by the interconnections that we discovered. You know, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the great German dissident and martyr to the Christian faith, was actually at the same concentration camp in Germany that as a young Elie Wiesel. Admittedly, they were on opposite sides of the camp. Bonhoeffer was still held in a specific prison, and Wiesel was just among the many incarcerated Jews.
Wow.
But these sort of very random connections in history where you wouldn't expect always struck me. Another one is that at the founding of the National Association of Colored Women, an advocacy organization in the United States, Harriet Tubman was the oldest member present, and the youngest person present was Ida B. Wells' infant son.
Christ.
So just the way these people's lives intersect and interconnect, and you really can't, there's a sense in which you can't understand Malala without understanding every leader that came before.
And it seems to me one common feature in the list is the battle against adversity. Is that something that you saw also, and what that might tell us about the development of moral leadership?
Yeah. Every one of these leaders not only faced some adversity, they faced hatred in a lot of cases. They faced personal sacrifice. Any sort of leadership, but especially moral leadership, is going to run into opposition because you're asking people to move from a state of inertia in a different direction. So there's no one in this book who was terribly popular, really, even in their own lifetime. Or I should say, everyone in this book experienced massive amounts of hate within their own lifetime, including people who within their own community who were very critical of them. So learning how to deal with adversity, both in terms of taking care of yourself and also finding your faith tradition, finding a spiritual practice that keeps you grounded in your faith in God or Christ, or if you're from a different faith tradition, staying rooted in a transcendent cause is incredibly important. But also learning how to handle criticism and grow and learn from it instead of just rebutting it and becoming very defensive. Every one of these leaders, they struggled with each of these things. None of them were perfect, but they all were models in many ways of how to do that process.
Colin, you said that you read this book with at your church with others. I'm just interested in what that must have been like to have an opportunity of others reading what you read and how surprised you were at the kind of things that they came up with.
Yeah, I was mostly terrified that they'd find something wrong. Every time they found, I think there's one or two typos, which I'm not going to tell listeners where they are. But every time they found those, I'm sure they delighted in that. Every time I've had a conversation, and I've also had an opportunity to sit in on some of David's classes as he teaches this book and in church, people will approach these leaders with different perspectives. And that's what's such a beautiful process. I would say I learned something about each of the leaders as I did this, but I learned way more about the fellow members of my church and members of my congregation, because I learned what they admire, what resonated with them, what struck them, who they see now as role models and why. And so I began to understand not just the leaders, because, you can dig into these lives endlessly, but I really began to understand the people around me. And that felt really good, because that was the main purpose of writing the book.
Well, time's almost defeated us, Colin, but there's just a little time to look in terms of any next projects that you've got coming up. You hinted at maybe there should be a part two of this book. Was that a serious thought?
Depends who you ask. I think that someone first proposed it when we were still trying to finish this one, and I told them they were crazy and they needed to walk away and let me finish this one.
Sure.
So I wouldn't say there's concrete plans here, but I do hope that the conversation begins, and we are trying to figure out ways to keep the attention on these leaders and keep the conversation going. For my own purposes, I will be ordained shortly and hope to go into ministry. And this sort of model, I think, is very productive for pastors or people who are going to be in very, very practical leadership positions, because they can understand, they have role models that emerge from this. And as I mentioned a second ago, if you sat down with people in an organization you're trying to lead and you walked through a book like this, you're going to understand what they look for in a leader. And then you'll know where you might meet that, where you might not fit that, where potential conflict areas lie. It can be very powerful. So I would say there might be more academic projects, but I also hope to be using this book just as much as anyone who's a reader out there.
That's fabulous. And that's within the Southern Baptist denomination, is it? You're going to be ordained?
I'm not Southern Baptist, but yes, Baptist.
Baptist, okay, sure. Good. Well, congratulations, if that's the right right thing to say as you come up to that. My God bless your future ministry. And so is that kind of, you're going to be writing in more in your spare time as opposed to as a living?
Yeah, it remains to be seen. I love telling the stories of these writers, and I love this topic and this opportunity to engage history. I think there's some themes in this book that need to be pulled out even more in future works. Confession emerged. That's not a huge practice within Baptist life and thought, at least compared to say a Catholic tradition, but each one of these leaders really led from a place of confession. They started with their own failures. That's a deeply resonant Christian theme for me, and one that I worry has been lost among some Protestant communities. So there's opportunities that hinge off of this work to sort of pick up on themes and keep moving them forward.
Right. Well, it just remains to give the details of the book for listeners who might want to get a copy. It's Moral Leadership for a Divided Age. Could you spell out the names of the authors for me?
Yes, that's David P. Gushy, D-A-V-I-D, P as in Patrick, although I don't know that's the initial, Gushy, G-U-S-H-E-E, and I am Colin Holtz, C-O-L-I-N, last name H-O-L-T-Z.
Fantastic. Thank you. And I've checked, so you can certainly get it on Amazon. It may be available in Christian bookshops in the UK. And it's also available on Kindle, which is where a lot of folk increasingly are getting their reading material. So,
and we have an audiobook. So, if you're on the train frequently, that's another option.
No, fabulous. Good. Well, Colin, it's been terrific to chat with you. Thank you for, I don't know if you got up particularly early this morning in Atlanta in order to do this conversation, but it's, you know, appreciate your time and effort to do this. And congratulations again on the book.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you'll be listening to The Leadership File again with me, Andy Peck. That was Colin Holkes, the co-author of Moral Leadership for a Divided Age. You can go to Premier's website to get archived versions of The Leadership File. Go to iTunes and other providers to get archives of The Leadership File, including this one in due course. I look forward to your company again next Sunday at 3:30. Thanks for tuning in.
You've been listening to The Leadership File on Premier. Andy Peck serves as a tutor at CWR, a Christian charity whose courses and publications aim to apply God's word to everyday life. Contact him via email apeck@cwr.org.uk.